Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. In a few minutes, we discuss pet behavior and health, but first we get an update on a bill in the state legislature designed to support canines working in the police force. With us, joining on the phone, is Representative Stephen Exaros from the 5th Barnstable District, one of the sponsors of the bill. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy and everyone. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. The bill is called Nero's Bill, in honor of the canine who was working with the Yarmouth police officer, Sean Gannon, when he was killed in the line of duty in 2018. Nero was wounded in that incident, but he did survive. And Steve, you were deputy police chief at that time. So explain the connection to Nero and what the bill would change about the current state law concerning canines in public service.
Yes, it's very personal to me and a lot of us. Those officers were on a mission to arrest a violent criminal. They left my office, and then 3 hours later, I heard them screaming for help. And I'll never forget that day. And we lost Sean Gannon, who was murdered, and K-9 Nero was shot in the head and trapped in the house. And we cleared the house with a SWAT team eventually, and we found Nero still alive in the attic. He was swallowing his own blood for 3 hours to try to keep his airway open. And when we brought him out, when the SWAT team brought him out, I was there, and all the EMTs and the paramedics and the ambulances were there, and they wanted to help, but in Massachusetts, they're not allowed. And we instead put him in the back of a police car, and a police officer held his airway open. And thank God we had a doctor. Dr. Khan was with the SWAT team, a real doc, a human doctor. And he stopped the bleeding and kept his airway open in the back of a police car when they drove to the hospital. So that taught us a lesson, and we tried to fix it. And Representative Crocker did a great job filing the bill. It passed the first hearing, and then it stalled. Mm-hmm. And that's really the main reason. There's many reasons, but that was the big point of me leaving my job to run for this position, and I'm proud to have been elected. Mm-hmm. And now we refiled the bill, and we're trying to get it over the goal line.
So, Steve, tell us what the bill would do. What does the bill change?
Currently, first responders, paramedics, and EMTs are not allowed legally to help an animal. And they're not allowed to put that animal in an ambulance. So we call it Nero's Bill, which allows them to do that. They'll be trained in, animal first responder duties. We have toughs on board to help train us at no cost. And the ambulances will be used to bring that injured animal in the line of duty to the local veterinary hospital to try to save their life. And, that was over 3 years ago, and it all came back on Friday, a horrible day for Massachusetts law enforcement, where we lost a police officer that was trying to save a drowning boy, and they both died. And at the same time, two police officers were shot by an armed career criminal, and K-9 Kit in Braintree, saved their lives. He went after the suspect, and the suspect shot him dead. Hmm. And yeah. It brought it all back to me personally, and it's kind of renewed our effort to get everybody on board. We have the MSPCA, we have the Animal Rescue League, we have everybody really all across the Commonwealth, all of our senators and representatives on the Cape, and we just want to do everything we can to make it happen.
So right now it's refiled and we're just waiting for it to be voted on? Is that to be brought up for a
vote?
Is that where it's at?
Well, it's been refiled along with 6,500 other bills.
Right.
And it has to go to a public safety hearing, which I'm on that commission, ironically. And then it goes to several other steps, and then it goes to the floor for a vote. But we're hoping, because of what happened on Friday, we can't wait that long any longer. It could happen again today. Mm-hmm. And we're hoping that there's some way to fast track it.
Right.
And that's what we're trying to do in memory of K-9 Kit and in honor of K-9 Nero.
Yeah. Representative Stephen Exaros from the 5th Barnstable District. Steve, keep us posted. Let us know, how the bill is doing. We appreciate you taking a few minutes to talk with us this morning. Appreciate that.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mindy.
Yep, you bet.
Thank you, everybody. Take care.
There was a marked rise in pet adoptions during the pandemic, and some people were seeking comfort, others companionship, others simply had more time to interact with an animal. Although there were concerns people would return adopted animals once workplaces and schools reopened, the American Veterinary Medical Association tells the New York Times shelters are not seeing an increase in surrendered animals. But as we return to our pre-pandemic routines and schedules, our pets could be surprised or anxious at the changes. For some animals, stress, anxiety, or an unhappiness can manifest in unwanted behaviors. With a little insight into the canine brain and modifications to our behavior, we can minimize or even eliminate those unwanted pet behaviors. And today we're going to talk about dog behavior and dog health. We'll also welcome other pet questions, medical questions, if you have for your pets at 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us is Ian Pullen from The Reliable Dog. Morning, Ian.
Good morning, Mindy. How are you?
Good. And also with us is veterinarian Stephen Atwood. Hi, Steve. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mindy.
All right. So lots of people adopting dogs during the pandemic. Stephen, have you seen an uptick in the numbers of people seeking veterinary care in your practice?
Oh, yeah. COVID has definitely resulted in more adoptions, medical needs, more visits in our office. It's expanded, you know, probably 50%.
Wow,
50%. 40 to 50%, a huge increase over the last year.
Yeah, we say people are not only adopting dogs but cats as well. I don't know, cats sometimes it's hard to control cat behavior, isn't it? The cats sort of have an independent mind of their own. Ian, puppies, dogs, they're wonderful additions to our world, but it does take a commitment to have a healthy, well-behaved pet, right? There are
absolutely
many different approaches to training. Some say it's more about training dog owners than the dogs themselves. I'm going to guess, and I should say for transparency, we adopted a dog in December and we hired Ian to help us with our new dog. And I would say, and I'm going to guess, that you would say it's both training the owner and the dog.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. The owner is a huge component. A lot of my training actually focuses on training the owners to understand the dog that's in front of them. You know, different temperaments, different breeds, and different training styles that work well for the owner-dog team. So, yeah, it's about 50-50. Mm-hmm.
Many people might think they have a well-behaved dog. Tell us how you would describe a well-behaved dog and what basic manners a dog should have.
Okay. For me, I'm going to go towards good manners as opposed to obedience. And the way that I define that is a dog offering a behavior on its own as opposed to us managing our dogs. So I'd like a dog to be calm in the presence of people, not over aroused, and not running back and forth from window to window when they're in home. Obviously a potty trained dog, right? So I want my dog to be looking towards me or towards the owner of the dog instead of outward in their environment to look for stimulation. Mm-hmm. So they...
And dogs do become members of the family, and sometimes we forget that they don't think like we do, and they're not motivated by the same things that we are. What are some of the most important parts of the dog brain that we need to understand if we want a well-trained dog?
Absolutely. Well, I think putting the brain aside, and that's more of a scientific analysis right there, I think what we can do as owners is provide more structure for our animals. And one, recognize that it is an animal, right? I like to think about it in about 3 to 4 different ways. One, that we do have an animal, right? Two, what it's a dog, right? So that plays into that comes into the game. And then what breed is that animal, right? Then after that, I get what we call the emotional side of that, which is for you, it's your dog Olivia. Right. Mm-hmm. For me, it's my dog Tages, the dog that we love. So if we can honor all those, that really helps us as dog owners.
Yeah. And it's really amazing once you kind of figure out what their motivation and why they're doing things, and sometimes how you're encouraging that without even realizing mm-hmm. it is amazing.
Yeah. Awareness of what's going on with our dogs is huge. And our dogs can be master manipulators, right?
So true.
Yeah. That's how they move through the world, right? What do they get from their environment? And you know, there's a saying one of my teachers had said, and it rings so true, that our dogs are watching us all day long. Like, it's us TV, mm-hmm. and we're reruns. So this plays into how dogs move through the world. And they're like, okay, I know that my owner's consistent or not consistent. Even when they think that they're consistent, the dog is... They know.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, it just reminded me, years ago, I had a German Shepherd. I lived on a lake in New Hampshire, and we had a canoe. We had a little Hobie cat, you know, it's like a catamaran, and then a water ski boat. And I was like, how does he know which he will run down and get onto the right boat every time? And I thought, what a smart dog. But it was clearly some kind of signals we were giving, like we're picking up a paddle or mm-hmm. we're doing something that gave him an indication which boat.
It could be.
Yeah.
Could be. And it also could be your dog could have a good mind map. Right. Mm. And so one of those signals, or you're definitely signaled by something, but also, hey, I know what we're doing.
Yeah.
And I know where to go because this is typically where we go.
In my mind, he was just brilliant.
Well, he was, yeah. Of course.
Steve, diet and exercise for dogs, just like for humans, this is essential to the health and well-being. So what advice do you give about what we should or should not be feeding our dogs?
Well, the higher end commercially available foods are so well formulated these days that people often sometimes feel the need to supplement. And it's, if you're feeding a high quality food, it's really not necessary. The high-end foods these days, and even the mid-range to high, are all, they go through a lot of standards that they need to pass. And so they're fine. And of course, exercise, depending on the breed. I mean, all breeds need some amount of exercise, some more than others. The healing dogs and the shepherds and the larger breeds sometimes require a little more exercise, and they're genetically programmed to run and run and run. And so they need more than a little smaller dog that might just stay in the house on somebody's lap all day. So,
what about people food? Is it okay to give your dog people food?
Well, they, the general consensus is as long as it's a minority component of their diet, if you're feeding a little bit here and there, especially if it's not, fatty or greasy, like gravies and things like that, you want to stay away from those things. Skin, chicken skin, turkey skin, the skins are terrible. Mm-hmm. But, a little bit of lean chicken meat or, turkey meat is fine. It's just, it shouldn't be the bulk of what they eat. And the danger, of course, if you start feeding too much human food, other than being relatively unbalanced for a dog, they'll end up preferring it. And then you've got this prima donna on your hands that won't eat anything but table food and won't eat dog food anymore. And that's the problem.
Oh, and they might gain a little weight. You're nodding your head, Ian, so you're going,
What
about, things like vegetables and rice? I know sometimes my grandson doesn't finish all his rice and his carrots and whatever, and he'll put them in the dog dish. Is that okay?
Yeah, I think the same thing applies. As long as it's, a smallish amount in comparison to the total volume that they eat, it shouldn't be an issue.
What about, you mentioned exercise. Can dogs get adequate exercise walking on a leash? You're saying some of the big dogs that like to run, you certainly aren't going to be able to run as fast as that dog, but is just walking them on a leash okay? Is that enough?
It's okay, but it would be great if they could run. I think it's better for them, but the trick is finding a place where they can do that safely and not get into trouble. And with, various regulations on beaches and so on and so forth, there's only certain times they can do that. So, if it's available to them, it's great.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that, Ian?
Yeah, I totally agree. I try to, my focus with the owners is seeing if they can drain their dog's brain a little bit more than the physical energy, because we do have leash laws. So it is hard for owners to get their dogs out and exercise them in that manner. And to do that, when they actually do that, they need to have some control for the safety of everybody else around them. So leash walking does become the primary means of exercise. So using our leash walking as a structured exercise actually gives the dog something to think about at the same time. So I find the combination of the two works well, as opposed to a long run. Now, granted, it's nice to throw a ball and have the dog run and run and run and run. I wish we had more space for that for dogs.
Yeah. So you're saying a combination of mental and physical exhaustion.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, there's some breeds need to run a lot, and some breeds have a lot of mental energy.
Yep. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626 for your comments, questions, or even stories. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about dog behavior and dog health, and with us is Ian Pullen from The Reliable Dog and veterinarian Stephen Atwood. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we were talking about food a minute ago, and Steve, I imagine you see overweight pets pretty common. What are the health risks, and what advice do you have for folks who are trying to keep their pets into a healthy weight?
Yeah, the health risks are the same as the health risks for humans. Heart disease, kidney disease, cancers, and so on and so forth. So the key is a lot of people think that if they just cut down the amount of the current food that they're feeding, the dogs will automatically lose weight. And that's not always the case. In fact, it's most often not the case. So it's better when you really, really have a morbidly or a severely overweight pet to choose a diet food, you know, that's designed and formulated for losing weight. And they're much, much more successful than just cutting back the current ration.
Mm-hmm. So, and then on the exercise end of that, if your pet is over, you want to, again, kind of ease into it, not, you know, increase exercise too intense at the
right. No marathons.
And of course, we live in an area where people enjoy walking their dogs off leash, and there's often interaction between dogs. Ian, what's the basic canine etiquette we should be following with our dog if our dog is off leash?
One, we should have our dog under direct verbal control. Right? We should be able to have a 100% recall. Mm-hmm. And now we know that everybody can't do that, and they don't do that. So I would advise not letting them go past a certain distance, right? And we want to avoid our dogs running up to other dogs right in their face, especially if the other dog's on leash. It's not fair to the other dog. We don't know the temperament of the other dog. Now, it doesn't mean that the other dog is there's something wrong with them. They might be shy, right? Mm-hmm. But we're taking away that dog's ability to choose whether or not they want to interact. So the on-leash dogs become forced into a situation that they didn't want.
Right, yeah. And for dogs who don't have issues with socialization or aggression, is it better for them to meet an unfamiliar dog on or off-leash?
I would say, I always say on-leash, mm-hmm. right? Because I actually advocate for the owners advocating for the dog space, not just leaving it up to the individual dogs, because we don't, you know, the average owner doesn't know how their animal's going to react in any given situation. So that being said, I'd like to see people have dogs meet walking parallel to each other at a little bit of a distance and maybe circling and getting closer and closer. You give the dogs time to get to know each other, and you give yourself a buffer in case anything should go wrong.
Mm. And as we mentioned, a lot of people who adopted dogs during the pandemic, and we don't know their histories, right?
Yeah.
And you said something interesting to me that I thought was really interesting. I said something about the dog being traumatized, and mm-hmm. you said probably not traumatized, but stressed. And that really does kind of sum it up. I mean, these dogs, even if they didn't come from really horrible situations, just that whole process of, you know, going into, you know, whatever, you know, rescue group they're with and transporting and all that, that's very stressful in a whole new environment that they're in. And I had read somewhere that it takes probably a good solid 3 months before you really start to see the dog's real personality. Do you agree with that?
I totally agree with that. And what tends to happen is we adopt an animal, and that's not the animal we see 3 months down the road. So there's things that happen within those 3 months that we tend to do with that animal that cause bad behaviors later on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you have the dog who tends to be aggressive when meeting new dogs, what's the best approach there?
Well, know the dog you have, right? I don't want to say avoid situations, but know where your dog's threshold is. Know how far you can go towards other dogs before your dog starts to react, all right? And set them up for success. And if I know that my dog is a little aggressive when we're around other dogs, like maybe that's not the best place for me to go there, because the more my dog repeats that behavior, they start to become addicted to the adrenaline and everything else that's going on in their brain, and it takes them a lot longer to settle down. Mm-hmm. So we want to work at a distance away from those dogs and maybe eventually get closer and closer.
And if dogs do get into a fight, mm-hmm. are there techniques to use to safely separate them?
There are, but for the average owner, it's really difficult. I don't advocate for putting your hands anywhere near the mouths.
You'll get bit.
Yeah. There are some techniques involving, either grabbing the hindquarters, one person on either end of the dog, and moving them apart from the rear, or even attaching a leash around the waist and moving backward. But again, these are kind of skilled techniques.
How about spraying them with a hose?
Well, if you have some water there, you can try, but you might. What tends to happen is sometimes during dog fights, one dog gets put at a disadvantage because that owner is pulling that dog and actually helping the opposite dog.
Oh,
so it's a difficult situation. Yeah. So if we can avoid
we
it,
can
let's
keep
avoid
them
it.
On a leash and that'll be helpful. Yeah. All right, let's talk to Janet, who's giving us a call from West Tisbury. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning. I recently had an unpleasant occurrence on my property. As you know, I have a horse.
Right.
And one of the neighbor's dogs came over. And I was in the house, and I heard this terrible commotion and barking, and I went out, and the dog was in the paddock with the horse, and the horse was upset.
Oh, boy.
And this is a very serious situation. Mm-hmm. I've had horses my whole life, and it's never happened. So I went out and yelled at the dog, and it was reluctant to leave. I actually chased it off the property. To make a long story short, it came back 5 additional times. I had to go to the selectmen's meeting, and I wish people would understand they cannot allow their dogs to run free and harass livestock.
Yeah. Yeah, Janet, that's a really good point. And, it would be great if we had enough room that we could, run free with our dogs. But you're right. I mean, it's not fair to the other animals. Ian, what are your thoughts on that?
Everybody's at a disadvantage in that situation. The horse, the dog. Mm-hmm. And both owners, right?
Yeah.
The horse might inadvertently do something to the dog,
right,
just by being scared. Like, that's just a bad situation. That to me, that's the dog owner needs to be more responsible.
Yeah. Janet, sorry that you had that experience. Thanks for calling in. We appreciate that. Eric is calling from Sandwich. Hi, Eric.
Good morning. I have a question about using wet dog food. I typically give my dog kibble, and then I add some canned dog food in as well. But I was recently told that the moist or wet dog food is not good for dogs' teeth, and that I should avoid that unless the dog is not interested in just eating dry kibble. And I'm interested in hearing about this possibility of tooth decay related to moist dog food.
Dr. Atwood?
Yeah, there seems to be more of a genetic component to that. Not all dogs can eat soft, moisturized, pet foods and get away without getting dental disease. Some cannot and some can. So it depends on the dog that you have. And, the only difference really between canned or moist pet food and dry is the moisture content. So nutritionally, they're pretty much identical. So, we tend to, or people tend to add moisture canned food because they think the dogs get bored by only eating dry food. And how can a dog eat this stuff day after day after day? And they try to do this thinking like they would think. So nutritionally, they're equivalent. If your dog can eat canned dog food or moistened dog food and not have dental problems, fine. It's a fine thing to do. But if it can, you shouldn't feed it.
Dr. Howard, what about, we hear about we should be brushing our dog's teeth. What do you think about that? Is that something we need to be doing?
Yeah, it's something that we recommend routinely. I'm not sure, as a percentage of the total cat and dog owning public will actually do that, because it's technically, unless you start it very, very young when they're puppies, it's going to be hard to do for some dogs. It depends on the personality of the animal. Some are easy to do, some are hard to do. But if you start it very young and you do, it's beneficial, it's a good thing to do. We recommend it, but not everybody can do it.
Yeah. Eric, does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're talking about on and off leash walking. We should also talk about predators. And Dr. Stephen Atwood, what are some of the predators pet owners should be aware of on the Cape and Islands, especially I would say probably more so for cats than dogs, right?
Well, my territory is the vineyard, of course, as you know. And yes. So we don't have an enormous problem with this over here. I think the local docs on the Cape would probably be better able to answer the question, but I'm told that there are coyotes there and so on and so forth, and cats and small dogs are vulnerable. And this is what I've heard from my colleagues over there. Here, we don't have too much of a problem with that.
Owls? What about cats and owls on the vineyard? Do you have any problems with owls attacking?
Hawks. Hawks and little animals.
And so do you recommend, since I know we're talking mostly about dogs, but let me ask you another cat question. Do you recommend keeping cats indoors?
In the winter time when the foliage is down and the hawks can see very well, if you have a very small or infirmed or older animal that's underweight and not as vital as a younger animal, then it might be better during the months when the foliage is off the trees to keep those animals in, if you can. Mm-hmm. But during the seasons when all the leaves are out and so on, so it shouldn't ordinarily be an issue, I don't think.
I'll only say this, that the bird lovers might say cats should be indoors all the time, right? Because they do kill a lot of birds. All right, skunks are not predators, but they can ruin your day if your dog gets sprayed. And we know there are lots of skunks on the vineyard. Steve, any tricks to get the smell out?
Well, the old faithful was tomato juice, which does work. It's a little messy and not pleasant to do, but it does work. And you just have to make sure you keep it out of the eyes, which isn't always easy to do because a lot of the skunk sprays are directly in the face of the dog. So you have to be careful with any of the stuff that you use. And there's a product called Skunk Off that's good. And then, there's homemade, potions that people will make with, dishwashing detergent and peroxide and baking soda, maybe vanilla extract, that sort of thing.
I would say Humane Society recommends mixing together 1 quart of 3% hydrogen peroxide, 1/4 cup of baking soda, and 1 teaspoon of liquid dishwashing soap. So kind of
that's
just
classic.
What you're saying. Yeah, there you go. Go ahead. What about you, Ian? What do you use for you when your dogs probably don't get sprayed because they're on a leash all the time, right?
Yeah, I haven't had that happen yet. And I hope it doesn't.
I had that happen. I used to have this little Bichon and I came home one night, it was maybe 10 or 11 o'clock, and I could smell the skunk. There's a skunk in the yard, and I opened the door to the house and it smelled worse. Oh. That was, All right. Stephen, what are some of the tick-borne illnesses that we have to be worried about? And are animal vaccinations available for most of these diseases?
The number one tick-borne disease we're seeing over here is anaplasmosis, or Anaplasma phagocytophilum. That's the name of the bug that causes it. It's tick-borne. And I'm going to say, because we routinely test animals out here, that maybe 65% of the dogs are positive for it. Wow. That doesn't mean 65% are sick from it or ill from it, but they're testing positive. So that's probably number one. Lyme would be number two, obviously. And then what seems to be emerging here is Rocky Mountain spotted fever. We're seeing more cases of Rocky Mountain spotted fever than we've seen in the past. And even now tularemia is transmissible, we now know, from ticks. It used to be that the general thinking was you had to be skinning a rabbit or a lawnmower accidentally hits a rabbit and it's aerosolized and you breathe in the organism. And now we know that ticks can transmit it. So those are probably the biggest four. And in terms of prevention, there's a very nice vaccine for Lyme disease that's been out a number of years now, probably in its third iteration. So I'd say 90% of the dogs on the island are vaccinated for Lyme.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there's all kinds of flea and tick medication or preventative stuff that you can give to your dogs, right?
Right. That's essential down here.
Yeah. And I would say the Rocky spotted mountain fever, that's because of the increasing Lone Star tick, something we didn't used to have. And now, especially on the vineyard, we're seeing a lot more.
That's right. And one other thing to keep in mind with the Rocky Mountains is that the transmission time is very low. You can pick it up within 4 hours, four or five hours after a bite. And that wasn't previously known. So,
All right. Let's talk to Fran, who's giving us a call from Brewster. Hi, Fran.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I tuned in a little late, and so you may have dealt with this question already. I have a dog who's 13 years old and experiencing a lot of arthritis issues in his hindquarters. He is taking some powerful medications, which are helping, but I've also heard that acupuncture can be a treatment that helps. And I was wondering if the doctor has an opinion on the effectiveness of acupuncture. And if so, is it possible to replace these medications with acupuncture?
That's a great question. And we're fortunate in our practice that we have a board certified acupuncturist on staff who's wonderful. And she has many, many, many clients that are receiving acupuncture currently for osteoarthritis and other maladies as well. And I'd say the results are very, very good. It requires a committed owner, and you have to sometimes have them treated, you know, a minimum of once a week. And some of these dogs will come in 2 times a week to get their acupuncture treatments. But if you stay with it, it's very effective, and it certainly can reduce the dependency on the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories and the other meds that are out there for treating osteoarthritis in pets.
Ah, Fran, thank you for the question. That was a good one. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about dog behavior and dog health with Ian Pullen from The Reliable Dog and veterinarian Stephen Atwood. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Virginia has a question. She says, I have a loving and wonderful 14-month-old Spinoni who is a COVID dog in the sense that he is now used to me being around all the time and has extreme separation anxiety, barks when I leave him to walk a different part of the yard or into a store, or God forbid if I leave him in his crate to go out of the home. I tried this for the first time and left him for 1 hour, which was probably too long, and he busted out of a metal crate. Any suggestions? Ian, this is a problem a lot of people are seeing, especially as they're returning to school and work, is separation anxiety.
Absolutely.
This sounds pretty extreme, but
Actually, it's not.
No,
it's just very common right now. I have a lot of dogs in school that we're running that have the same issue. They tend not to have it with us as much as they do with their owners. So, whenever we have an issue like this, we want to go to our structure. What does our home structure look like? We don't want to just flood the dog with a bunch of crating all at one time, right? Little bits at a time is great. So, what I see happening is the dog is free and has the ability to do whatever it wants throughout the day. And then we use the crate as a tool of management when we need to do something. Instead of using the tool as, as the crate as a tool to teaching calm, relaxing behavior and periodically throughout the day. I mean, so we advocate for a structure of we have some downtime with our crate, maybe come out and we limit space a little bit more. Maybe the dog's tethered or it's lying on his dog bed, and then there's a little bit more freedom. Right? This also allows our dogs not to make mistakes that we don't want. Right? So this is where we can isolate bad behavior and reward good behavior. But in the same time, they become desensitized to being away from us. Right, so the dogs get used to us being separated, and we can do this in drips. Right, so we can have our dogs in the crate. The dog's calm. I can leave the room, come back in, reward, maybe reward with food, or reward with getting out of the crate. Then we can slowly make that period of time a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. So just putting in the crate and using it when we have to typically goes wrong. So we have to get them used to that.
What do you do with dogs who are not crate trained? Who, you know, maybe you've gotten a rescue dog that's not crate trained. How do you deal with that?
One, we try. Mm-hmm. You know, we start to get them used to the crate, or we limit space as much as possible using baby gates, maybe a little bit of tethering. Depends on it really depends on that dog's personality, if you would, or their temperament, and most of all, their sensitivity level. Right, because we're not going to just make separation if the dog is going to freak out. It's not going to work. But we limit space as much as possible.
Mm. Steve Atwood, I'm wondering your thoughts on separation anxiety. You know, sometimes some people have extreme cases, and I know there's often medications. And do you, when you do medications, do you advise some training in the meantime so that the dog doesn't always have to be on medication? How does that work?
Well, the first thing I'd say is I totally agree with Ian that that cases of this can be so extreme. I remember one where you had an elderly couple here on the island that had a fairly large shepherd type dog, and they couldn't leave the house without the dog. It had to go everywhere they went. Mm-hmm. So if they left them alone, it would completely destroy the house. The dog had to go everywhere. When they went to cocktail parties, they took turns in the car with the dog because if they both went into the cocktail party, the car would be destroyed. So it can be really extreme. Yeah. But in terms of, if I had, a patient like that, I'd probably work with a trainer to start with. And if that would fail, if they weren't able to make, progress, or if their trainer recommended trying some meds, there's certainly things that you can try. Anxiolytics to make them less anxious. Mm-hmm. There's a number of meds that we could try to help them.
Yeah, this idea of limiting their amount in the house, I'll say it works because, Ian, we adopted a shepherd, and she had a little bit of, I don't know, what do you call it? Not aggression, but the prey drive or something. She thought she had to guard the whole house, right? And so she would, rush to the door. She'd jump up on the couches at the windows and be barking at everything. She doesn't do that at all anymore. And I think it was like 80-20? You said 80% of the time you're controlling where she is, 20% kind of letting her decide.
In the beginning.
And it really works. I mean, she doesn't jump on the couches anymore. She actually can sit at that front door with the door open, and people and dogs walk by, and she's not freaking out. Yeah.
I like to call that taking their bills away.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
When she's not stressed out. So when I said structure, I guess a good way to think of that is genetically appropriate structure, right? These are pack animals, and they're also going to respond in the way that this is where their breed comes in, right? So your dog, who is a German Shepherd, has a lot of defensiveness built in, possessive behavior built in, right? This is what we get when we open
that box.
Didn't
train her that. She's that. Yeah,
that's what it is, right? So how do we tell her not to do that? Well, we're going to, while we're teaching her other things to do, we take that stuff off the table. I'm not going to allow you to make these choices, right? So when we take those choices away, in the beginning, when we take the choices away and we allow the choice for her to make the right decisions, she becomes less stressed. And then as we're teaching her obedience, what we want her to do, the right things, lying down in your dog bed, being calm, and then giving her an appropriate outlet, then we can start to allow the other choices to come back in. And they tend to make better choices after that.
Yeah, it's amazing. All right, Janet is giving us a call from Yarmouth. Hi, Janet.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. So I have actually two questions. I have a 15-year-old dog. She's 19 pounds. And about 6 months ago, she started having these uncontrollable chattering of her teeth. Her jaw would just start chatter, chatter, chatter. I called it a seizure. The vet said, no, it's maybe dental problems. And because she's so old, they didn't want to do any dental where they had to put her under. And they put her on gabapentin, I think it's called. It's a painkiller. And so she takes it twice a day. She doesn't have the seizures, but is there any downside to just keeping her on this medicine?
That's you, Dr. Atwood.
Yeah, good question. No, I think both answers are it definitely could be correct. It could be dental disease, or it could be some sort of low level seizure activity, or even a form of dementia. Sometimes they'll do this as they really get older and they become a little bit demented. So no, the gabapentin is fine. We use it routinely for that and other things as well. Arthritis, actually, it's one of our anti-arthritis meds. And no, there's no problem with it. Probably should have blood work checked every 6 months or so to make sure her liver's handling it well. But beyond that, it's quite safe.
All right, Janet, what was your other question?
Well, the other question is about ticks. She takes the pill that you give and it lasts for 3 months, but it doesn't repel ticks. They actually, they have to bite the dog and then they die. And I have been finding live ticks in the house, which is really disturbing. And I'm wondering if it is, is it better, or what's your opinion about the kind of like a front line that just that repels the ticks as opposed to these, the medications that kill the ticks?
Yeah, obviously, if you can prevent a bite from occurring, you're way, way better off. You know, we use a lot of the collar products out there because those seem to work very well. I mean, there's a little bit in the media about them having adverse reactions. Of course, we've not seen that, at least not in very large numbers at all. So that product does repel, and the ticks are unable to bite. And so, you know, we use quite a bit of that. The topicals, if they're labeled for that, fine. Anything that would work. But I sort of philosophically agree with you. It's much better to prevent a bite than to deal with the after effects after the bites occur.
Janet, thank you for the phone call. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Ian, there are instances when dogs consider their human a resource and become aggressive when others, you know, children's, partners, friends want your attention. What are the ways dogs communicate this, and how do we handle those situations? How do we kind of cut this off at the pass before it happens?
Well, the communication of it from the dog will be a little obvious to us at the last stage before they explode, let's say. Right? It starts subtly. The dog might just walk in front of the owner and stand sideways in front of them and block off from the guests. And we kind of ignore this. Mm-hmm. Right? We ignore their body language all the time, and then we see the extreme side of it. So subtle signs, like I said, blocking off the owner, maybe a little growl, right? So what can we do about it is, I think, the more important question. So if we don't have a lot of obedience training on our dog, then we need to go to structure again, right? I like that word. Let's provide our dog with more structure, right? We're not going to just allow the dog to follow us around the house when we have guests here. We need to manage them. We have many tools for managing our dog, right? We can use our crate if we know we're going to have guests and our dog's not that comfortable with guests. We can even use a tether, a leash attached somewhere where there's a dog bed. And now the dog can be with the family, but can't be allowed to get in between people and make those bad choices. If it does happen, one, we have to stop it right away, mm-hmm. right? But the thing that what causes it is more of a possessive behavior, right? And it's allowing the dogs to be on us in our space all the time, right? And it goes with the breeds that you wouldn't think, right? Sometimes we see it a lot in smaller dogs, not just the dogs like you may think, like the Belgian Malinois and the German Shepherds and say some pit bulls. It happens a lot with some smaller breeds that are allowed to be on our lap all the time, and then they're like, well, no, get away from this person. It's mine.
This is my lap.
Yeah. So structure and management at first. And then, you know, I like to, you know, we teach our clients, you know, a place command or a bed command. So my dog is now controlled by like, no, go lie down. And my dog's on their dog bed, and that's what they're focusing on. They're not really focusing on what their human's doing at that time.
Right. Steve, some dogs love to swim in salt water and some dogs love to drink salt water. First, can swimming in salt water bother dogs' skins or coats? Is that okay?
Swimming in salt water is great. It's really therapeutic for dog skin. The key, though, is to wash the dog off with fresh water, rinse them off after they come out of the water. When you get them home, because the salt dries, just like with us, it's itchy.
Yeah.
So bad news, and you don't want them to be damp anywhere, especially under their ears. Drinking salt water, not an issue unless it's an enormous amount.
Oh, okay, so it's okay.
We actually recommend salt water for animals that have gotten into rat poison and other things to make them vomit. So it's actually something that can encourage vomiting. At low levels. At high levels, yeah, you can get salt poisoning, but dogs generally don't drink a lot of the stuff.
Oh, interesting. So at home and out in the world, there are substances that are toxic to dogs. What are some of the more common ones that we should be concerned about?
One that a lot of people don't really realize is the sugarless gums with xylitol in them are really, really toxic. That's bad. Raisins, grapes, bad news. A lot of people don't know that. Chocolate, everybody knows. Onions. Poinsettias, there's all, deadly nightshade, all kinds of plants, the mushrooms, the poisonous mushroom you got to watch out for. So, but you know, the sugarless gum is the one that a lot of people don't know.
I didn't know that either. So here's another question I'm sure everybody was, why is my dog eating grass? Why do dogs eat grass? And is it true that dogs can get worms from eating grass?
No, I mean, I suppose it's possible if a dog that had worms went near where your dog is eating grass, and there were, you know, worm eggs on the grass or associated with the grass, he probably could consume them. But generally, no. Why do they eat grass? Because it's an indigestible cellulose. It's like a cleanser, an internal cleanser. They eat it because it makes their tummy feel better, they think.
Yeah, that's what they do. Like chewing a little piece of parsley after we have dinner or something.
It tastes good, too.
Yeah, it tastes good. Ian, what do we know about the intelligence of dogs? And what are some of the ways we can test or assess our dog's intelligence? I think they're far more intelligent than we think they are.
Yeah, that's a big question. Big question. So Dr. Stanley Coren has written multiple books and one on this, just on this topic. So, and he breaks them down into three categories, which I agree in. One is instinctual intelligence. So that's more genetics, like how good of a herder is my herding dog, right? Then there's adaptive intelligence. How does my dog move through its environment and manipulate the environment? And then working in obedience. Can I teach my dog to do these behaviors and how well does it learn from me? Where I focus is actually not on the obedience, surprisingly, right? Mm-hmm. I want a dog who's adaptive because I like a dog who can, a sign of intelligence to me is who can manipulate their environment and make their way through the world. And I think I told you about this before. It's like, I like to teach the dog to manipulate me to do the things that I want them to do. Right. So learning comes easier to them if they can figure things out for themselves instead of me having to micromanage them all the time. Right. So that's where we get their good manners. But a couple of there's some pretty funky tests out there that like putting a towel on your dog's head and seeing how long it takes for them to take it off. Right. One that I do think is pretty cool, though. You know, you take three cups, put a piece of food under it as the dog watches you and let them go and get that food. Right. Then do it with the dog in the other room and then see how long it takes. So you're kind of testing their mind map at that point. That's a pretty good one. But I want to see how much the dog can manipulate me. Mm-hmm. And it drives most dog owners crazy. But to me, it's a sign that my dog's on the right track. And we just have to use that to our advantage.
Yeah. And a dog can learn it. And, you know, they say an old dog can't learn new tricks. But they can. The dog we adopted is 6 years old. And again, not knowing what kind of training, if they've had training, mm-hmm. and I'm sure you get this with people who have rescued dogs all the time, mm-hmm. they can learn.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people who say my dog's very stubborn and they're not that bright. And I see the dog and I'm like, this is a very intelligent dog. And it knows that that you're not going to back up what you're telling them to do. So they don't do it.
Yeah. Steve, you've got about a minute left. What are your thoughts with people who are looking for, you know, that pet? How do you advise people on you know, what pet they might best be suited for their situation?
I think the first thing is what kind of lifestyle they have. If they're going to be away a lot, take that into consideration. If they have, you know, a fair amount of land to let the dog run a little bit, that would influence my decision. Shedding, some dogs shed a lot, some dogs don't. Allergies, hypoallergenic breeds that tend to be more hypoallergenic work for, you know, people that require that. And the size of the dog, how, you know, how much it eats, how much it, how the genetic issues that you need to be aware of before you entertain, you know, getting a certain breed, because some are known to have more problems than others in certain areas. So you got to do your due diligence.
Yeah. So do your research basically before you. Yeah. It's not an impulse buy for sure. All right. Dr. Stephen Atwood, veterinarian in Martha's Vineyard, and Ian Pullen from The Reliable Dog. We'll have links to both at our website, capeandislands.org. Thank you both. Very informative hour. Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Being
it's
here.
Been fun.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.